Welcome to the Deep Dive. Today we're diving into a First Amendment battleground you might not expect. Abortion clinic buffer zones. We're unpacking Hill v. Colorado, a 2000 Supreme Court case that still has a major impact on protests today.
Yeah, it's really incredible how this case highlights the tension between two fundamental rights, you know, the right to free speech and the right to access healthcare without being harassed. We'll be exploring the Colorado law that was really at the heart of it all, how it affected so-called sidewalk counselors and the complexities of the Supreme Court's decision.
So by the end of this deep dive, you'll understand why Hill v. Colorado is such a landmark case, especially with more recent developments like McCollum v. Coakley in 2014.
Right.
And how the overturning of Roe v. Wade might bring this case back into the spotlight.
So first, let's head back to 1993.
Okay.
Colorado passed a law that created a 100-foot buffer zone around a healthcare facility. So imagine kind of a bubble extending from all the entrances.
So if you were within that 100-foot zone, what exactly were the restrictions?
Well, the law made it illegal to knowingly approach within 8 feet of someone without their consent if you were trying to hand them leaflets, display signs, or engage in what the law called oral protest, education, or counseling.
So that's where those sidewalk counselors come in.
Exactly.
Those individuals who are often trying to dissuade people from entering the clinic.
Exactly. The plaintiffs in Hill v. Colorado were a group of these sidewalk counselors, and they argued that this 8-foot, you know, floating bubble violated their First Amendment right to free speech. They felt they were being unfairly silenced.
So how did the Supreme Court handle this clash between free speech and the desire to protect patients?
Well, it was a split decision,
but
the majority ultimately upheld the Colorado law. So you can think of it as a balancing act.
Okay.
They weighed the right to free speech against the government's interest in protecting patient access to health care and ensuring their safety.
Okay, so one of the big issues the court had to figure out was whether this law was truly neutral or if it was targeting anti-abortion speech specifically.
Right. Was it regulating the manner of speech, like saying you can't blast your message through a loudspeaker at 3 a.m., or was it trying to control the content of that speech, which would raise some serious First Amendment concerns?
So did the court see the 8-foot floating bubble as content neutral?
The majority, led by Justice Stevens, argued that it was. They said it didn't matter what the message was, whether it was pro-choice, anti-abortion, or something else entirely. The law simply regulated how close you could get to someone without their consent while engaging in certain activities.
So in their view, it was more like a time, place, and manner restriction.
Exactly.
Like you could have a protest, but maybe not right in the middle of a busy intersection during rush hour.
Exactly. They pointed to a previous case, Ward v. Rock Against Racism, which dealt with noise levels at concerts in Central Park.
Oh, wow.
And the court had set up a test for these kinds of restrictions, and the majority in Hill felt that the Colorado law passed that test.
So what were the main points of that test? Help us non-lawyers understand.
Essentially, the law had to be narrowly tailored to serve a significant government interest, which in this case was protecting patients and staff from harassment and ensuring access to healthcare.
Okay.
And it had to leave open other ways for people to communicate their message.
So you couldn't get right up in someone's face, but you could still hold signs, chant slogans, even distribute leaflets from a reasonable distance.
Precisely. The court said the law didn't prevent sidewalk counselors from expressing their views. It just limited their ability to approach individuals without consent within that specific zone.
That makes sense, but I imagine not everyone on the court was thrilled with this decision.
Oh, absolutely not. There were some strong dissenting opinions, especially from Justice Scalia. He saw the Colorado law as a clear case of viewpoint discrimination.
Meaning he felt the law was specifically designed to silence anti-abortion speech.
That was his argument, yeah. He thought the law's focus on activities like protest, education, or counseling was a way to target anti-abortion advocates who rely heavily on those face-to-face interactions. He believed that the law should have been subjected to strict scrutiny, meaning the government would have to demonstrate a much stronger justification for the restriction.
Interesting. So even though the majority felt the law was neutral, Justice Scalia saw it as a way to muzzle one side of the debate.
And Justice Kennedy, while not fully agreeing with Scalia, also expressed some concerns. He worried that terms like protest and counseling were too vague and could lead to uneven enforcement of the law.
So his concern was that the law could be applied in a way that unfairly targets certain groups or viewpoints, depending on who's interpreting it.
Exactly. He saw the potential for a chilling effect on free speech, even if the law's intentions were good.
Okay, so we have this major Supreme Court decision, a divided court, and strong arguments on both sides. But this was back in 2000. Does Hill v. Colorado still hold up today?
Well, that's where things get even more interesting, because while Hill v. Colorado is technically still good law, the legal landscape around these buffer zones has shifted since then. We need to look at another Supreme Court case, McCollum v. Coakley, decided in 2014, to fully understand the complexities here.
Ooh, another case. Another legal showdown. Sounds like we're just getting started.
We are. McCollum really highlights how even seemingly settled issues can be revisited as new challenges arise. Get ready for some more twists and turns in the world of buffer zones.
Can't wait. Let's dive into McCollum v. Coakley and see how it builds on, or maybe even challenges, what we've learned from Hill v. Colorado.
So, all right, let's shift gears to 2014 and step into the world of McCollum v. Coakley. This case, just like Hill, deals with buffer zones around clinics, but this time we're in Massachusetts and the law is a bit different.
Okay, so what was the Massachusetts law trying to do? Was it even more restrictive than the Colorado law?
In a way, yes. This law established a fixed 35-foot buffer zone around the entrances, exits, and driveways of abortion clinics. So you can picture a solid line drawn around the clinic property, and nobody could engage in certain speech activities within that zone, period.
So no matter what, even if someone was open to hearing what they had to say, the sidewalk counselors couldn't approach.
Exactly. And that's where the plaintiffs in McCollum, again, mostly anti-abortion advocates, took issue. They argued that this fixed zone was a much broader restriction on their speech than the floating bubble in Hill.
Okay, so they felt it was like a more drastic measure, preventing even those consensual conversations that were still technically allowed under Hill v. Colorado.
Right, and this time the Supreme Court surprised many by striking down the Massachusetts law unanimously.
Unanimous. That's pretty rare, especially when you're dealing with something as controversial as abortion and free speech.
It is, but what's really fascinating is that even though they struck down this law, the court didn't throw out the entire concept of buffer zones. They actually relied on Hill v. Colorado as precedent to explain their reasoning.
Hold on, that seems confusing. How can they strike down one law about buffer zones while relying on a case that upheld a similar law?
Well, it's a bit of a legal puzzle. But the key is in how they distinguish between the two cases. Remember, the court is always looking for very specific details. In Hill, the 8-foot restriction only applied when someone was trying to approach another person without their consent. It still left open the possibility for those consensual interactions.
So you could still have a conversation if the person entering the clinic was willing to engage.
Exactly. But the Massachusetts law in McCollum didn't allow for any of that nuance. It was a blanket ban on any kind of speech within that fixed 35-foot zone, regardless of consent. It was much more rigid.
Ah, so the court was drawing a line. They were saying, look, we're okay with regulating the manner of speech to protect vulnerable individuals, but you can't just create a speech-free zone around an entire clinic and call it a day.
That's a great way to put it. Chief Justice Roberts, who wrote the majority opinion in McCollum, emphasized that the First Amendment doesn't give the government free rein to restrict speech in a traditional public forum just because someone might find it offensive or uncomfortable.
So if we connect this to other situations, that would mean you couldn't just ban protests near a government building or a political rally just because some people might be bothered by it.
Exactly. And the court acknowledged the government's interest in protecting access to clinics and ensuring public safety, but they said those interests have to be balanced against the right to free speech in a reasonable way.
Okay. It seems like the court was saying that Massachusetts went too far in its attempt to protect patients. They kind of overstepped their bounds when it came to First Amendment rights.
That's a good analysis. McCollum showed us that the court is very careful about looking at whether a law is truly content neutral, meaning it doesn't discriminate against a particular message, whether it's narrowly tailored to address a specific problem, and whether it leaves open other ways for people to express their views.
So lawyers and lawmakers have to thread this very fine needle. They have to figure out how to balance free speech rights with the need to protect people from harassment and ensure access to essential services.
Precisely. And this balancing act is made even more complicated by the fact that the law is always evolving. Even with Hill and McCollum setting some guidelines, there are still so many unanswered questions.
Like what? What kind of legal mysteries are we still grappling with when it comes to buffer zones and free speech?
Well, for one thing, the landscape has shifted dramatically with the overturning of Roe v. Wade in 2022. Now that states have very different laws regarding abortion, we have to ask, how will these buffer zone cases play out in a post-Roe world?
That's a huge question. It feels like Hill v. Colorado, even though it was decided over to 2 decades ago, could suddenly become much more relevant as states try to navigate this new reality.
It absolutely could, and the implications go far beyond abortion. The core principles at stake in Hill and McCollin are relevant to all sorts of protests and demonstrations. We see these debates happening around buffer zones, at places of worship, at military funerals, even at political rallies.
So this idea of content neutrality, balancing free speech with other rights, figuring out how to regulate protests without silencing dissenting voices, these are ongoing challenges that we're all facing as a society.
Exactly. These aren't just abstract legal concepts. They have real-world consequences for you and for everyone who cares about the future of free speech in this country.
It feels like we've only scratched the surface here. So much to think about. What's the one big takeaway you want our listeners to walk away with from this deep dive into buffer zones and the First Amendment?
It's amazing how a case from 2000 about buffer zones at clinics can suddenly feel so relevant to all sorts of protests and demonstrations happening today. You know, it's like Hill v. Colorado was ahead of its time.
It really was. And if we connect this to the bigger picture, it's not just about physical spaces anymore. You know, think about online protests, virtual demonstrations, the metaverse, all these new digital frontiers where the lines between speech and conduct are becoming even blurrier.
Right. And that's one of the big questions that comes up.
So could we see Hill v. Colorado logic being applied to, say, a virtual protest in a video game?
Right.
Or someone using augmented reality to project protest messages onto a building. Could those be considered buffer zone issues?
It's definitely a possibility, yeah. The court's reasoning in Hill about protecting what they called captive audiences and balancing speech rights with other interests could easily be extended to these new digital contexts. You know, it raises a whole new set of challenges.
This raises an interesting question for me then. How would you define a captive audience in the digital age? We're constantly bombarded with information online from all directions. Is anyone truly captive anymore?
That's a great question, and it's one that courts are going to have to grapple with as technology advances. It's a much more complex landscape now than it was back in 2000. We might see new tests, new precedents being set as courts try to figure out how to apply First Amendment principles to these digital age dilemmas.
So lawyers of the future are going to need a whole new set of skills to navigate this world, right?
Absolutely. They'll need to understand not just the traditional First Amendment doctrine, but also the nuances of technology, virtual spaces, and how people interact online. It's a rapidly evolving field.
It feels like we're just scratching the surface here so much to think about. What's the one big takeaway you want our listeners to walk away with from our deep dive into buffer zones and the First Amendment?
I think the key takeaway from Hill v. Colorado and all these cases we've discussed is that law is not static. It's a living, breathing thing that's constantly adapting to new challenges. And as technology and society change, we can expect even more clashes between free speech and other rights, more debates about how to find that delicate balance.
So we need to stay informed, stay engaged, and keep those critical thinking skills sharp.
Exactly. The future of free speech is being shaped right now, and it's a conversation that we all need to be a part of.
Well, thank you so much for guiding us through this complex legal terrain. And all our listeners out there, keep exploring, keep questioning, and join us next time for another deep dive into a fascinating and important issue.